When the U.S. entered World War II, American forces were under attack.
So where are we?
We are standing in the Senator John Alario Special Exhibits Gallery, and we are in the special at the National World War II Museum, of course, and we are in the special exhibit, Our War II Women in Service. This opened on Veterans Day 2023, and we had quite a number of female veterans with us for that great event, including two of the World War II veterans who are featured in this exhibit. So it was a really special moment. Unforgettable.
And they're featured in this new kind of interactive.
They are concept. Featured in a new interactive that we have here in this exhibit in our War II, where we feature three female veterans. But we also have this interactive in our Forbes Rare and Iconic Gallery, where we feature 18 World War II veterans from all service branches.
I've seen the displays in Forbes. It's really a cool, so it's like sort of the next thing, you know?
It's pretty incredible. So, you know, being having been with the museum for 16 years, I've met a lot of veterans and I've talked to them quite a bit, and it still happens, but it's pretty rare. Something that was an everyday occurrence, being able to talk with veterans, chat with them, you know, about their experiences or about, you know, what they had for lunch or, you know, whatever. That is becoming increasingly rare. And within our lifetime, you know, within the next 10, 15 years, we'll see the last World War II veteran pass away. And so that's something that we always have in our mind, is how to extend the conversations with the veterans and how to perhaps give a glimpse of that to people that might never meet a World War II veteran. And that's something that we do in Voices from the Front. We enable a conversation-like experience, let's say, where you can query, you can ask questions to a veteran and receive a response. And a number of questions, you know, from what's your favorite color to what did you do on Iwo Jima? Were you scared? You know, those kinds of things. So it's it's new technology, uses AI to some extent, and natural language processing and indexing. But it's pretty exciting to see this and where it's going and how people respond to it.
And it seems like such an organic extension of the tradition of oral histories here, and how that so much of the collection and so much of the exhibits are built on the idea of these first-person narratives.
I mean, we really try to put the personal experience front and center and highlight the words of those who lived through it. And so whether that's through oral histories, through memoirs, through diaries and letters, all kinds of personal accounts. And that's something that we have really done throughout the museum's life, and even prior to that, really, with the work of Dr. Stephen Abrams. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, let's talk about this. This is mostly drawn from the collection.
This is drawn from the museum's collection. So our exhibit on service women of World War II is pretty groundbreaking in that we've had some smaller exhibits that have highlighted women's service. And we do have material from service women in our other galleries, but it doesn't really tell their story, how they got there, how they fought to get there, and the path that they took in the service, what they did, and how that affected service women today. So this is the first exhibit that really focuses on the story of service women.
And how do you go about, with something that's this comprehensive, the question to me is how you go about, one, organizing the visitor experience, mm-hmm. telling a story in acts, and then combining that with the objects and images and the storytelling tools that are available. And had you been, for the years you've been here, watching artifacts and things come in related to the women service members?
Absolutely. So a big part of what I do at the museum is collect material. So I talk to individuals who have material either from their own service, which is increasingly rare now, but was pretty commonplace initially. I'm usually speaking with the children of veterans who have material and bringing material into the collection. And so I've always had my eye on, you know, what's coming in, and really have had a hand in bringing that material in. And there were a few pieces of, well, women's material has always been high on my list of things to collect, desirable material. Mm-hmm. And so some of the items in our War II are very rare. They're some of the rarest items in the collection. You wouldn't even think it, perhaps, like material from the Wasp. Mm-hmm. So there were only 1,000 women who served, who flew military aircraft with the women as women Air Force service pilots. Mm-hmm. And so we have two collections featured in this exhibit from 1,000, you know, a unit that was only formed of 1,000 women. Mm-hmm. So it's very rare.
Mm-hmm. And yet probably one of the best known of the, is branch the right word, or?
You know, it's not quite a branch, I guess. Right. It's, you know, we call them an outfit. Mm-hmm. So the Wasp were not recognized as service members. And that leads me to my next point, which is that this exhibit tells a really big story. Rather than focus on any one of these units, you could make an exhibit certainly on the Wasp and what they did, or on the Women's Army Corps. There were 150,000 women. They were the largest. The Army had the largest women's presence during the war. You could make a great exhibit on any one of these individual components, but we really wanted to tell the story of women's service in that general, broad, comprehensive way. And so we included all of the official service branches, the Army Nurse Corps, Navy Nurse Corps, and the Wasp, who were finally recognized in 1977 as veterans. So they're not, they were seen as contractors at the time.
Are the Wasp objects so rare because there were just so few members?
Yes. Yeah, that's part of it. And also, the war was still going on when they, when the Wasp program was disbanded. So they were disbanded in December 1944. I said, thank you very much for this job. And now back to your regularly scheduled program. Mm-hmm. And so they were not allowed to keep a lot of their material. And I think generally, you know, you're not allowed to keep everything that you were issued during the war. Mm-hmm. So they could select certain pieces that they wanted to retain. So there are still items out there that we don't have from Wasp. For instance, they had a beret that went with their uniform. We don't have one of those. But the pieces that we have are exceedingly rare.
One of the sort of storytelling things I really liked about this, and I'm going to go on, but I love the idea of the trunks. Yeah. One, because maybe that's what the service members use, but they're also how a lot of these artifacts survive to today in attics and basements. And I don't know what the intention was, but that's how it sort of plays for me. That's one of the really neat storytelling things. The other one for me was using the uniforms to tell the stories of the different outfits, branches. And because it's linear and really easy to follow, and the uniforms sort of pull you over to learn some more. So we're in sort of the portion of the exhibit right now that focuses on sort of the recruiting time and all of the really clever collateral that was produced. And that's all the way through this. It's like pamphlets and And I always wonder about the instinct to save those things, mm-hmm. grandma's stuff or whatever. So what is the narrative? Starting with Trailblazers, those were women in service before the war, right? As I understand it.
Yeah, and this tells the story, you know, women were always there in wartime, and they were, you know, played important roles, but maybe were not part of the official forces. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to make sure that we mention that and talk about some of those important figures and the roles that women played in American history in wartime. We also have an introductory film because that tells a little bit of the story of World War II. Mm-hmm. So part of this exhibit's life will be on the road, the next part of this exhibit's life. So we have a traveling exhibit program, and this exhibit, when it closes here, July 21st, after that, after it ends here, it will take it on the road. So this will be a traveling exhibit. So at other venues, people don't have a whole museum around them to provide that mm-hmm. context. So we talk about why women's service was even a thing. You know, why mm-hmm. were women considered? And that's because the war was so massive. The need was massive. And so women were able to use that time to push for inclusion.
And then the war came, and the push to recruit and encourage women to serve really becomes a priority because of all the different roles they could fill, all the different roles that are represented in the exhibit.
Yes, and so the recruitment efforts were aimed not only at the women themselves, women who were going to enter the service, but also at the general public and at family members of those women, because part of the, I guess, propaganda campaign around the recruitment was to sell this idea that by entering the military, you weren't going to become a man, one. You weren't going to be in extreme danger. And, you know, you weren't going to be immoral or, you know. So it was selling service in a way to the general public, making it more palatable, perhaps, than because the idea of a woman in uniform wasn't acceptable to most at the time. So a lot of the recruitment posters focus on that. And similarly with women who worked in production. You know, Rosie the Riveter isn't necessarily grimy and dirty. At least J. Howard Miller's Rosie isn't. Norman Rockwell's is a little more maybe what realistic. But so the women that you see in the poster are very posters, recruitment posters are very stylized for the most part. They're also all white women.
Sure.
Which isn't reflective of a reflection of, you know, all of the women who wanted this opportunity, who wanted to take part in defense of their country.
Sure, and the appeal to patriotism is sort of a strong sell or selling point.
Absolutely.
Do a job so that a serviceman can do serviceman things.
Serviceman things, yeah. Right.
All right, well, thank you for...
Yeah, and a lot of, you know, that's another, you know, serviceman things, to go back, to circle back to that. When you think of what men were doing, a lot of that was the same thing as what women were doing. You know, not every man was on the front lines.
Right.
So it's, you know, that's something that's not necessarily discussed, mm-hmm. that a lot of men were sitting behind typewriters or were driving officers around, mm-hmm. or, mm-hmm. you know, what have you. So they were doing that work as well. Only, as, you know, a percentage of men were in combat on the front
right.
lines.
Right. And the point about them not being women of color in this display, that's also something that you address elsewhere in the exhibit, of the different types of women who served and the fight that they had to serve, which is a really important point to make, and one that people maybe don't think about.
Yeah. And you know, I talked about rare material in the collection. We have extremely rare material from African American service women. Before our first collection from an African American service woman, besides oral histories, which we do have, did have some of those over time, but our first collection of artifacts came in just 3 years ago. So it was really groundbreaking, you know, to have a family present that material to us. We have a uniform from Women's Army Corps Corporal Teresa Maybell, and I have used her as our representative Army personnel. She was part of the storied 6888 Central Postal Directory Battalion.
Right.
She was also from Louisiana. Yeah. She became a teacher. She was a teacher prior to the war. She was from Baton Rouge. And she ended up teaching for the rest of her life after service in Maringouin, Louisiana. And I was able to speak with some of her students because I wanted to know, she's no longer with us, but I wanted to talk to people that might have known her. And she inspired so many people in Maringouin as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked two individuals, I asked them if she talked about her Army service or if they even knew. And they said, no, we didn't know. She didn't talk about it. But something was different about her. You know, they said she was very firm, but not strict, or, you know, she talked differently, she walked differently, she carried herself differently, and everyone wanted to be like her. And a lot of these young people went on to go into education. And so, you know, I have to think that that had something to do with her service, or at least it's connected in some kind of way.
Mm-hmm. And so wonderful that the family was able to save these.
Yeah, and it was perfect timing for, mm-hmm. you know, and that was, it was wonderful because the donor said, oh, we've been meaning to reach out for a long time, but we just, you know, haven't done it. So there is material still out there from service women, from servicemen, that in attics and basements, you mm-hmm. know, in closets, mm-hmm. in foot lockers,
right,
around there. That you know, we are noticing business is booming, you know, with artifact offers, at least with. As
boomers downsize.
As boomers downsize, yeah. Exactly.
And I'm right there.
Yeah. And so, you know, every single day we are offered material. And I'm glad of that because that's how we've built our collection. Mm-hmm. Sadly, we can't take everything into the collection.
Sure.
But so that's how we've built our collection. And I'm really glad that you singled out the uniforms standing as representations for the branch or the outfit and for the women themselves, because that was our intent,
mm-hmm.
really. This I think is my parade formation of women.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You know, we have uniforms scattered throughout, but we wanted to make this stand apart, and the central element where we have dress uniforms from each of the branches. And we wanted them to be dignified in a way, mm-hmm. to show them, because they were very proud of these uniforms.
Yeah, and that's addressed somewhere, somewhere on the wall. It's about uh-huh. the cost of the uniform is yeah. addressed in one of the collateral pieces, and how they're, which I love, and also something that everybody can sort of relate to. And that the uniform was sort of a selling point.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a selling point, in particular for the Navy and the Coast Guard, who had these designer uniforms, and you know, that was, it was really, there were ad campaigns, best dressed woman of the year, and she's, it's someone wearing wearing a Navy uniform. Cover Girls in 1944, you know, there were these campaigns that were, that really built that up as well. But they are sharp looking.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and you know, the from the cape to you know, the more naval looking, it's really a wonderful display. And then it's just sort of the centerpiece of the room. It's sort of the I stopped and read every word. So, success.
Thank you. I tried to make as few words as possible. That's, you know, one of the struggles when putting together an exhibit. There's so much to say.
Yeah.
But really, you have, you know, limited space and limited time, I guess, with which to capture a visitor.
And visitor attention is always a concern, I'm sure.
So, you know, the idea is to say as much as possible with words as possible, perhaps, but, and to say things in different ways. So we use, you know, the visuals, large scale graphics. We use the films, the AV pieces, the sound. We have the soundscape of women marching. We have label text, of course, and artifacts. And then we have an interactive. That's just one of my. This was one of my favorite parts of working on this exhibit.
This was something that just stopped me completely until I could see it all, until I looked at every single thing.
It's a lot, Dave. You must have been here a while because there's so much content in here.
And so many great little, I'm going to quickly move through this because I wanted to point out the one thing. Just a presentation thing, but it's something to look for. I assume this will travel?
It will.
Good. This. Because that's how those are stored. That's the, with the scotch tape and that fold up. And we're looking at a clipping of women's activities. And anyway, this, to me, this is one of the great storytelling things in the exhibit, or for that matter, in the whole museum. Because I'm sure so much of what is saved and collected is in scrapbooks. And was that sort of the inspiration for presenting it this way?
It was. I love, absolutely love scrapbooks. And the museum has hundreds of scrapbooks in our collection. And I think of them, you know, they range from almost photo albums where it's simply photos with captions to really thick, fat albums with any kind of material imaginable, you know, corsages, sugar cubes, whatever. In this, in this interactive, we have flatware, you know, silverware that someone pasted into a scrapbook, so mess hall fork and knife.
Right.
So the idea behind this was not to, was to showcase the scrapbooks, but not just to recreate one and turn the page, but to build something new that incorporated elements from lots of different scrapbooks. Because we want to talk about all of the branches and different experiences and different types of women even. And so to that end, we developed the scrapbook, Our Time in Service, which is actually a, you could buy a commercial product that was called My Time in Service.
Oh, really?
A blank book.
Right.
But we were a little more inclusive. Our war, Our Time in Service goes with Our War Too. And we divided it into separate categories, like themes that appear throughout most scrapbooks: daily life, service milestones, love and friendship, rest and recreation, and stories from home. And we used those as organizing principles. And there are lots of little surprises throughout.
Right.
Things that pop up, unfold, animation.
And it really becomes sort of a scrapbook for all women in service. It's like the, it's like a meta scrapbook,
yeah.
Right?
I love it. And then you can click on individual components and sometimes learn a little more about their items.
And that's it. My dog tag is exactly how it would have appeared in a scrapbook with someone explaining what it was.
Mm-hmm. So we tried to stay true to the scrapbook elements. We didn't force anything or necessarily put things in here that we haven't seen in actual scrapbooks. It was hard to, this was one that was hard to dial back. There's only so much you can include, but the content is so great that.
Right. You could spend an hour or more to look at it all. And people should. It's really cool and captivating. So well done on that. And it's, again, it's sort of one of the centerpieces for me. The other centerpiece is going to seem weird, but the patches robe.
Oh yeah.
And and that, it's noted in the text that the patches related to the enemies are placed on the seat, which to me was so much the spirit of what was happening. But how is it? Can I ask about individual objects and like maybe how they came? Do you know the story of how that?
You know, I need to think back on this one.
Oh, okay.
I think so. This was given by the veteran, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a piece that was sort of maybe unfinished, and that's, we do see that kind of thing where we have the robe with the patches. So patch collecting was a fairly common activity during the war. We have large patch collections and other items with patches on them, jackets and another robe even.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see in the pocket of this jacket, there are additional patches. So, you know, this is like a project maybe that didn't quite make it to fruition. But patch collecting was great. It's like an autograph book. It's a way to record your experiences, or a scrapbook in a way. You know, all of these things are kind of remembrances. And yes, the enemy patch, the swastika is on the seat of the robe. The Army Women's Museum also has one on display, and the patch is in the very same place. So I have to assume that was somewhat commonplace. You know, someone saw it and said, oh, that's a great idea. That's really funny. I'm going to do that too.
And it's a craft. You know, it's a way to kill time, but it's a way to also, you know, keep them all in one place.
One of the things that I enjoyed about this exhibit as well are, you know, the other thinking of these elements as tools of war. You know, when you're going through the other galleries and you have this sort of tools of war, and there are machine guns and there, you know, it's a bazooka or, you know, what have you, but we have desk name plates.
Right.
These are also tools of war, typewriters.
All things that were requisitioned, that were part of the arsenal of democracy.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. So we have a collection in this case here that was from a woman who was part of the presence at the Casablanca conference. So she was with the Army, Women's Army Corps, Louise Anderson. She was a stenographer, and she was part of a very, very small group of women that left England to go to North Africa in December 1942 in advance of the January 1943 conference. And their ship was torpedoed, and right outside of where they were going to land. And so they made it there safely. They were picked up by a British destroyer and brought into port, but they lost everything, their clothes, their uniforms, you know. But I think this is a great, it's hotel stationery notes, a floor plan from the Anfa Hotel, where the Casablanca conference, where the Americans stayed and the conference took place. And I think this is a great example of, you know, women were there. Women were present at these important events. They may not have been the ones who were photographed shaking hands. They were maybe not the ones who were, you know, making all of the decisions, but they were the ones who were recording it and saving it. And so I think that's, I like to highlight this piece.
And how great that it was saved and to tell that story. And did I read, did the president actually request her specifically to be something like that? Or?
So Beadle Smith requested her specifically because, yeah, there was a story about how when they land and they're completely, you know, shipwrecked, basically, they're drenched and they have nothing and they've been through this traumatic experience. One of the generals says, I picked the one that looked just the most pitiful. I didn't want her to feel bad. So, yeah.
Great. I wanted to talk a little bit about the analog interactive of the code.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to just highlight, while we're on there, I don't know if you remember the volunteer, Frances Hoffman. She was probably here. So we have... Mm-hmm. She served as a Marine, and we have some of her uniforms. So it's great to actually be able to use some of the material from women that I actually met here at the museum.
Right, and who was at part of the museum family.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's wonderful. The role of women in this work is, it's great that it's recognized here, because it was important work and... many of them were uncredited or couldn't, the story of how they couldn't talk about it.
Right, so code work in particular and intelligence work is really difficult to research because people didn't talk about it. They were instructed not to talk about it, and they took that to their graves sometimes. So finding out what women and men did in terms of cryptanalysis and cryptography is really difficult. But we have some good researchers and some great institutions who have devoted time to telling that story, and so we know a lot about what people did now. And, you know, it was very strenuous work in terms of brain power, you know, mental focus, required a lot of focus and ultimate security, you know. Also, maybe you might know one part of what you were working on, but not another part of how it fit into a larger story. So it required a lot of focus.
Right. And a lot of time in the chair. You know, it was that maybe the hardest kind of service.
And a lot of time in the chair. And I think, you know, that wasn't for everyone, certainly. You know, some of these, you know, behind you, you have women who were in the cockpit. You know, that work probably would not have been for them. Their work required a lot of extreme focus and skill, but very different talents and amazing ones, you know.
Yeah. One quick question about the traveling nature of this. How does, as a curator, was this intended to be a traveling exhibit all along? And then how do you approach what the work, even the staging, when you know that it'll have to pack up and travel?
So it was intended to be a traveling exhibit. And so certain pieces were, I guess, conceived when we designed the exhibit, we did take that into account. So, but this is a big traveling show. So you think about how much it takes to pack all of this up. This exhibit has more than 200 or around 200 artifacts, slightly more. And So that is a lot of material that needs to be very, very sensitively handled and traveled around.
Is the first destination set? Do you know where it's going?
The first destination is not yet set.
Okay.
We've had a lot of interest, which is great.
Mm-hmm. It's a big exhibit.
It is a big exhibit.
Yeah.
So, but it's, you know, I think it tells a compelling story that a lot of people don't know. And so
sure.
It's bringing new information to the public in a way.
And would fit in all kinds of institutions, not necessarily a museum dedicated to wars or service. There are all kinds of different ways for this to work. Let me ask again about the opening and the story of the interactives, and then we're all done.
So the woman who is speaking to us right here is Virginia Wilterding. She was an Army nurse during the war. And she was here at the opening November 11th, 2023. And she just has a lot of energy. She actually told me that she's the one who told me that I look tired. I must be working too hard. The other individual, this is Romay Davis. So she must have been 103 at the time because she's 104 now. And so she lives in Montgomery, Alabama. She had brothers who were in service. We have their oral histories as well. And then the third veteran that we have featured here is Florence Smith, and she served with the Coast Guard. She passed away after the exhibit opened. She wasn't able to come to the opening, but she's since passed away. Her family came, including her granddaughter, who retired from the military. And so she talks in our film, Legacy Film, her granddaughter is featured and talks about what it meant to have a grandmother who served in the war. And that's a different angle. We have, I've incorporated stories from a few different women who had grandmothers who served. And when you think about, you know, what that means, you know, like grandmother wearing combat boots, you know, it's a nice story. So my boss, Erin Clancy, her grandmother was in the Marines. One of our former colleagues here at the museum, Kara Jane Williams, her grandmother also was a Marine. So it's great to be able to connect the stories of women who served in World War II and then women who are doing great things today, either in the military or...
And it's a connection from Trailblazers to the legacy, and we're today, I think, there's not a novelty about women in the armed forces as much as it would have been during World War II. It's like become part of our defense, you know, in almost every job.
Yeah, I mean, women can perform any role in the military, but they still make up 16%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's of course much greater than in World War II. You know, you had 350,000 women and 16.1 million Americans serving overall. But you know, women, the presence of women in the military, yes, people don't. It's not a surprise when people see a woman in uniform. Part of our legacy film tells the story of how there's still some work to be done in terms of gender equality in the military, in terms of protections against, you know, sexual violence or other discrimination. So. We do tell that story. It's sort of an ongoing story. But women have made tremendous strides, and that this exhibit is also a celebration of those achievements of the women in World War II and how they really laid the groundwork to opening up the military, opening up all of the ranks and roles for women who who serve today and creating new opportunities across the board.
Yeah. Is there anything that you had hoped we'd talk about that you would that I didn't ask about? Any objects or anything thematic?
You know, in terms of work, you asked about working on the exhibit and, mm-hmm. and what goes into it. I had a lot of great advisors on this project, and some of them were veterans and who served after World War II, but had, you know, that firsthand experience with World War II veterans or with the Women's Army Corps, even in the post-war, in the Vietnam era, for instance. So I had a lot of great advisors who are veterans, but then also historians. So I formed a network of female historians who specialize in either World War, certain aspects of World War II history or women's military history. And that was really essential to getting the story right. So we worked with some academics, but also museum curators. So Britta Granrud, who's the curator at the Military Women's Memorial at Arlington, Britta advised on this, and that was really an important part of telling the story in the way that the women would want their story told.